Hello, I'm Michael Han. Andrew Harrison is on his holidays at a facial hair grooming retreat where he is being taught how to look like Ron Mayo out of Sparks. So for the next 2 weeks, you've got me standing in on Big Mouth, the show for people who think too much about pop culture. Today we're going to be talking about the new albums by the Norwegian pop star Susanne Sundfør and Brooklyn chin-stroking favourites The National. We're also going to ask what Sky TV can teach us about rock and roll and wallow in the misery that was Nick Broomfield's Whitney Houston documentary. Even though Andrew's away, Matt Hall, the man they call the Lucinda Pryor Palmer of the podcasting world, is in the producer's chair. Hello, Matt. How have you been?
I've been very well, and I'm very excited, because tonight I'm going to go and see Ghostface Killer.
The Clapham Grand, is that right?
Well, actually, we've recorded this earlier in the week, and I'm going to see him in Nottingham, in my hometown, where Nottingham, of course, which is a great hotbed of hip-hop.
People always say that Matt Hall was only built for Cuban links.
That's exactly
Is that the right member of Wu-Tang?
No, well, he... nearly.
We're joined today by two guests, and what Matt doesn't realise is that this week's guests have been carefully selected, so we can, if it all goes wrong, just talk about the Guns N' Roses show we went to together this summer. First up is Sophie Hayward, a writer who interviews pop stars, film stars, and is working on both her first novel and a memoir. Sophie, what was your favourite thing this summer?
Not including Guns N' Roses.
I was just about to talk about Guns N' Roses. Well, I went to LA for a month because I'm very lucky. And I went to what is now, it's become very big, this festival in LA in the summer. It's now called FYF Fest, which is a bit of a tautology, I think, because it stands for the Fuck Yeah Fest Fest. And when it started out, I went in about 2008 when it was really a bunch of very sort of indie kids in a car park, literally in a car park. And then have just a few sort of guys on stage shouting, and maybe the most famous band would be sort of somebody from Liars doing a side project. And now it's so massive, they had Missy Elliott, Frank Ocean and Nine Inch Nails headlining. But somehow, they did a really rare sort of festival feat, which is keeping it really lovely and friendly feeling and not sort of full of celebrities and style bloggers. It just really seemed like a bunch of people loving the music, and it was great. So Frank Ocean at that has, I mean, he's turned into Stevie Wonder. Was unbelievable.
He's gone blind.
Yeah, he's gone blind. No, just he's gone from being, you know, a rather talented singer to just this incredible sort of performer on stage, and we were all falling in love with him. And then Brad Pitt came on stage, surprise guest, and he serenaded Brad Pitt because he writes love songs about men, which is quite unusual. And Brad Pitt, recently divorced, was sort of there lapping up this man love, and it made us all go a bit funny, I think.
Was it as good as Guns N' Roses?
Nearly as good as that show we went to, Michael, of Guns N' Roses at the Stratford.
At the
Stadium.
Stratford. The
Stratford. Stratford Wicks.
Yes, Hollywood with Brad Pitt was nearly as good as a reformed hairy rock band from my youth.
Our other guest is Robin Turner, music publicist, music writer, and the only Big Mouth guest to have played Regular John by Queens of the Stone Age for Fidel Castro. So, Robin, what would you play for Kim Jong-un if you were asked to DJ for him?
Probably nothing off the new Queens album. I don't think he'd like it. It's a bit too frisky, I think. I reckon he's old school. I think he's probably a bit more hair metal. You know, I mean, there's probably an amount of time, you know, it takes for records to bed in over there, probably 20, 30 years.
So, Open Up and Say Ah by Poison?
No, I think Dr. Feelgood by Motley Crue. I think, you know, it's got the right amount of kind of, we're going to go to war. It's got that kind of feel to it. It's made me go to war several times. Yeah, I think he's old school. I think he, you know, his look is definitely hiding something, isn't it? You know, he wants the $75 razor shag haircut.
What did you, I think his hair actually is, he's trying to pull a bit of a Josh on me. I think probably is a devoted Queens fan.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I was looking at his hair today and thinking, is that the new hipster haircut? Mm. Is that the one that people are going in going, can I have a Kim?
Many, many years ago,
Helen Kim,
when his dad was still running North Korea, The Guardian, and I was slightly embarrassed about it, so about 15 years ago, ran a feature on, is Kim Jong-il the best-dressed man in world politics? And it's one of those kind of head in hands. He kills people. He starves people. He imprisons people. You shouldn't be treating him as a joke fashion icon.
Name and shame the writer.
You should treat him as a joke metal.
I mean, we never do that.
We're staring down the barrel of a nuclear war. What's the problem? It's gone too far now.
This reminds me of the horror I experienced when reading Grazia, and they said, let's face it, we're much more interested in Sam Cam's frocks than David Cameron's policies. And I thought, I have to stop reading these magazines. This is really distressing.
Before we get started, let me give you a friendly reminder. If you use an Apple device, why not subscribe to Big Mouth via Apple Podcasts? You can do it via the podcast app on your phone or go to the iTunes Music Store. And please give Big Mouth a lovely review and a star rating too. It all helps butter up the evil algorithms that control everything and gets us in front of more listeners. We will be really grateful. Matt Hall will come to your house and bake you one of his sourdough loaves. That offer may not be fulfilled. Android people, don't worry. You can get us on Stitcher and Audio Boom too, as well as on Spotify. Let's move on to Suzanne Sunfor, who first started getting attention in the UK for her fourth album, 10 Love Songs, in 2015. It was an extraordinary synth-pop edifice pitched somewhere between ABBA, Robin and Nine Inch Nails, and it won her rave reviews and a deal with Bella Union. Now she's returned with a new album, Music for People in Trouble, that might prove a bit of a surprise for people who are expecting 10 more love songs. Let's have a listen to Mounted Ears. Sophie, did Music for People in Trouble make you want to hear Sunfor sing more, or did it make you want to give Sunfor what for?
I really enjoyed it, but particularly, well, I have to say, I was in my office and it slowed me right down from sort of looking at emails and making constant phone calls. It slowed me down so much that I found myself sort of walking from my office chair backwards across the room to the sofa and having a little freelancer's lie down. And not a full freelancer slide down, because I think that involves self-love. But I sort of fell into this lovely rapturous slumber. And then Mountain Ears, that song, is that the one that features John Grant?
That is the one.
It came on and it sort of builds. It's such a slow crescendo. I sort of woke up to this amazing rapture in my office, which is actually above a betting shop and opposite a branch of McDonald's. And I was sort of suddenly in this, you know, amazing sort of crescendo landscape. So I absolutely loved it. But I can't fill you in on the two songs prior to that.
That's quite all right. You don't need to. This is the podcast where vagueness and non-specificity is actually welcomed.
Yes.
Had you heard 10 love songs before listening to this?
Yes, I had. And I do think this is sort of pulled right back, isn't it?
It's pulled right back.
And then further back. But it's got that lovely, what do you call it? Is it Hawaiian steel guitar? That kind of wow sound on it.
Could you do that sound again? Thank you.
Lovely steel guitar.
I was interested. I think Bella Union is probably the right label for it, because I was among those people expecting 10 more love songs.
Yeah.
And I imagine that if she'd gone to a major, they would have been a bit, hang on, love. Where's the big synth pop?
Yeah, synth pop can't be applied to her anymore. Well, not at this point with this record. Yeah, I don't know what an A&R looking for hits would say, but I think she's not really, as you say, she's not really in that world.
What did you think, Robin?
I really liked it. I was quite surprised by it, because I'd assumed it was maybe going to be a bit more dwarf.
Yeah, no doofs.
And the first track I found quite light. It's probably a sort of pretty vague word for it, but it was all quite moon, June, spoon.
It actually opens, I'm as lucky as the moon on a starry night in June. Looking down on a lagoon, I'm as lucky as the moon. Which doesn't fill you with hope.
No. Then I found myself sort of lulled into a bit of a false sense of security, where it kind of cuts loose into, and this is the ultimate cliche at the moment, it cuts into a kind of David Lynchian, you know, it suddenly puts some space in there, and it's then it becomes interesting. And then later on you get these tracks which I couldn't work out what was going on, which I loved, which is where this chap just starts intoning these strange, slightly nonsensical pieces of information, and it's like
kind of weather forecast.
It was a bit shipping forecast, actually, over these this kind of ambient, this pulled ambient music, which I loved that. And I thought, more of this, please. And by the time you get to the last track, Mountain Ears, the John Grant one, it's sort of absolutely demented. I mean, within the context of being a very nice, mellow, very listenable record, it's this false sense of security thing that you, by the time you get to the end, you kind of don't know whether you're coming or going. I really like that. And when I've gone back and listened to it, the first track still really jars with me. It's like, I can sort of get the idea that maybe it is trying to soften you up to something else. I mean, it's not softening you up to an Opeth record or a... but her voice really reminded me of Emiliana Torini. I was kind of expecting something a bit more Bjorky, but it isn't. It's that kind of, you know, it's very enunciated, very quite proper. I liked it. It wasn't, I mean, I've listened to it, you know, I've got two small kids who never let me listen to any music at home other than Yo Gabba Gabba. And so this has been listened to exclusively on several long tube journeys. And as you can imagine, that's not really the best place to try and consume this music.
So it's worth pointing out, we talked about the opening line, I'm as lucky as the moon in June. The final song, Mountaineers, opens in a rather different mood with jumbo jets spiralling down like vultures of the stars, soaring above barren lands of boiling tar. Which does sound actually rather like Opeth.
Yeah. Well, I kind of got that last song became to me a bit. I was trying to think. It sounds like the kind of music that you'd get onto a really portentous financial services ad. It's kind of all this swelling and kind of, you know, the rest
very
of it.
Crescendo.
Do you think she should be clad in a black cloak and hood? And,
I kind of got the feeling with that.
Widow,
and then I was
basically.
Thinking, would it? Should it? Yeah. Then I was thinking, well, should it be kind of a rugby tournament? Should it be the kind of music for a rugby tournament or something? Once
the
John Grant gets going, totally.
Yeah.
Which kind of is a bit strange because the rest of it, and here I display my kind of complete lack of reference points for glacial female Scandinavian pop, but I was thinking Stina Nordenstam, and have they ever been seen? Because she hasn't done anything since 2007, which mysteriously is when...
Susanna
came on the scene, and I'm like, hello.
That's one of the greatest bits of listening Googling, isn't it? Hang on a minute. What?
Stina's got that very sort of idiosyncratic voice, isn't it? It's
yeah.
Contained.
This is
crackle.
A lot more.
It's very.
Yeah.
I should declare an interest at this point because, as many of you will know, some of you might not know, when artists release new albums, they go in search of journalists who've raved about them before and they pay them money to write a thing called a biog, a kind of 2-page interview that goes out with their new album. And because I raved about 10 love songs, I was asked to write the Suzanne Sunfor biog. So because I have a financial relationship with this pop singer, you cannot trust a word I say. Let's make that plain. Obviously, I probably wouldn't have done the biog if I didn't think the album was good, because I'm not that mercenary. But from talking to her about it, there's quite a lot of interesting context around it, because after 10 love songs, she pretty much had a nervous breakdown. She'd done almost everything on that record herself. And she needed to do something completely different. She went travelling around the world, visiting places that she thought were in danger of changing immediately. North Korea among them. It all comes back to North Korea.
No, she didn't.
She did. I'm not saying she's directly responsible for the current crisis.
But she nudged it along.
She probably did, didn't she? I think it was the Moon June rhyme that really inflamed Kim Jong-un. And she kind of more or less retreated from the world. She made this album very much more on her own.
In North Korea?
Not in North Korea.
Right.
Methods of recovery from a breakdown, that is the best one I've heard. Go and see how shit your life really could be if you lived in the worst dictatorship in the world.
And also, she said she was, her very first record was a singer-songwriter record, and she got interested in doing synth-pop, but she's always identified with singer-songwriters. I also spoke to her the other week for something different for The Quietus, one of their Baker's Dozen features, where every record she picked was a singer-songwriter record. That's clearly absolutely where she comes from. So the synth-pop stuff was the diversion. I think this is the real her. The Mike Yarwood style, and this is me. But she's a fascinating writer, I think, and you know, she's one of those people who cleaves to the view that Joni Mitchell is better than Bob Dylan.
Absolutely true.
I have no horse in this race, to be honest.
I'm with her.
I'm not arguing with you, Sophie. I'm not arguing with Suzanne
Sinfor. I'm arguing with myself, and I will carry on.
But I think it's... it is a very, very dark album, isn't it? I mean, you get, as Robin says, you get fooled by the gentleness. There's a way she has of expressing things that is seen so blindingly obvious as to be almost embarrassing at times, but is clearly absolutely heartfelt that gets quite entrancing.
So is it a knowing, the lyrics kind of... Is there some kind of irony going on, or are they just really simple lyrics?
I should have asked her, is Moon in June? Are you having us on with that rhyme, aren't you?
I always feel when, you know, she's Norwegian. I mean, I always feel when you're singing in your second language, some allowance should be given. However, Scandinavians are better at English than
we are. I've got to say, she has excellent English,
I must say.
We've got a bonus album discussion this week because we've also been listening to Sleep Well Beast by The National. Over the past decade, the Brooklyn-based Ohioans have become, quietly, a little bit massive. But few bands manage to sustain that quality across seven albums. Can The National break the mould, or are they succumbing to difficult seventh album syndrome? Here's a little bit of Day I Die by The National. That was Day I Die by The National. Now, Robin, do The National pass the Guns N' Roses test?
I really like them. They were a band that completely passed me by until High Violet, and I always used to see them on Glastonbury bills, and they'd be really high up, and you're like, who are they? Mm. You know, I remember they headlined the Peel stage really early on. I think they might have even got second headline on the other stage before High Violet came out, and you're like, hang on a minute, what the... You know, they had no idea about them. And then you know, like probably most people who were turned on by that record, Blood Buzz Ohio is just one of those records. And if I'd been 18 and going to indie clubs, that's probably the record that you meet. Get on the dance floor. So I'm a fan. This record I really like. I wished it had a Blood Buzz Ohio on there. The one that really got me, I think, was the one that sounds like the Bad Seeds.
I know which one you mean. Was it Turtleneck?
Yeah, Turtleneck. It's absolute chaos. It's kind of Bad Seeds, Gallon Drunk. It's kind of chaos to it. I really like the use of electronics in there, but yeah, I loved it. I was just waiting to be
transported. Yeah. I was about to say something really stupid, so I'm going to backtrack on that and just say I always find The National difficult, not in the sense that the music is hard. Just that nothing they have ever done has registered with me. I've listened to this album five or six times in the last 2 days, but still, literally the only thing I can remember from the entirety of The National's career, having seen them several times, having listened to all the albums, is Squalor Victoria. And I probably got that wrong. I probably got the melody line for that wrong. But that is the only thing that's ever stuck. And I don't know why this is. A lot of people I know and trust implicitly think The National are one of the greatest groups of all time, and I simply cannot hear it. I think there's something in that modern indie way of making music that I find really hard to relate to. I grew up with rock and roll. I like conventionally structured riffs and verse, chorus. This way of making songs using almost blocks of sound, I find...
Well, it doesn't...
It creates surfaces that I can't get a fix on at all.
It's kind of quite studious, isn't it? By which, you know, it's like, oh, we need that bit in, and then we need that bit. They don't go with it, man. I don't think they ever... You never get the sense that they've let themselves go, even when they're creating a right racket.
Well, what they play on is the tension between major and minor, usually. Their other records, which I think, I mean, I need to listen to this more and more. I'm hoping it's a grower, but like you, I've had a few plays and it hasn't quite sunk in like the others, but I think they've lost the sort of tension of the minor key. They're very good at having the sort of gaps between their notes and the gaps between their songs are very slight. There's only very narrow differences between what they do, so you have to listen quite closely. I think on this, they've got songs that are sort of pootling along in a major key and going where they're meant to go. And I think we've lost that sort of slightly, you know, chafing tension of the minor switchover.
I find them a peculiar band. The first time I saw them live was actually in a tent at a festival in the mid-afternoon. And I thought they were incredible. I mean, I heard a couple of good things from people. I thought they were incredible. A few months later, I went back to see them at the Electric Ballroom in Camden. And I thought, well, this is going to be fantastic, isn't it? Because it's their proper headline show. And I ended up being bored rigid and just going out and smoking.
Did you have a seat? Because I think with national gigs, it really, perhaps I'm showing my age.
I saw them
you
once.
You really
with a seat.
Need a seat.
I've left seated national gigs early as well. The thing is, this thing, I keep going back and trying with the national. Yeah. I really do. And it just doesn't work for me. The older I get, the shallower I realise I am. And anything of any depth just leaves me cold. All I want, frankly, is Neighbours and Van Halen. Matt, what did you think of the National?
I just have this vision of the National whenever I hear their records of their archetypal fan, and I think they're fans, and I think they're a couple in that painting, American Gothic. They just look really. I admire them, and I admire what they do, but I don't get any sense of fun out of it. And I just think that everyone's a bit, you know, I think they, I don't know whether they attract a particularly po-faced audience because of the music or whether that those people just kind of enjoy that kind of, it's not math rock, is it? But it's got that kind of, there's too much thought behind it. I'm kind of with you on it. There's not, you know, I don't feel there's enough explore, just letting go and seeing what happens, you know. I kind of get the thing that if a band like The Band were around now, this is what they'd be doing. But I'm quite glad that they're not around now because this, yeah, it's a bit cold.
I would predict that 75% of Big Mouth listeners think the National are great.
Probably a lot of people do, you know.
I mean, I think they're great. I just hope this album's a grower because it hasn't grown on me yet.
Has anyone else here read Meet Me in the Bathroom by Lizzie Goodman?
I can't wait to start it, but no, I haven't read it.
I read the bits that feature my friends, which is really terrible.
Yeah,
various friends of mine are in it. Well, I cannot wait. Have you read it?
Yeah. Well, for those who have somehow avoided excerpts,
what were the other?
Book?
What was on the other three pages, Robin?
No, it's literally three pages. Where I'm bands I've worked with are quoted as like, do they come out all right? Yeah, they're all right. All right, fine. Put it away.
For those who've somehow managed to avoid the excerpts from Meet Me in the Bathroom, which have appeared across all newspapers and magazines this summer, it's an oral history of the New York rock scene from the early 2000s through to 3 or 4 years ago. And so the first half is mainly about Manhattan and the Strokes and the Moldy Peaches and Interpol. The second half is mainly about Brooklyn and Williamsburg and the groups there, and the National, of course, featuring that. And it's quite interesting, the divide between the two things. In the first half of the book, you've got rich and upper-middle-class kids going to the Lower East Side, taking loads of drugs, and then saying it's all different now, it's all gentrified. Well, whose fault is that, lads? Then the second half, you've got rich and upper-middle-class kids moving to Brooklyn and Williamsburg, not taking loads of drugs and being very serious, and then complaining about gentrification. Again, whose fault is that, lads? But Matt Berlinger of The National has a story in there about living in probably the worst street in New York, certainly according to his version, and leaving a street one morning. I think it's finding a shoebox full of entrails in the middle of the street. And that's his illustration of how difficult it was for The National.
Matt Berninger, who now has a house in Brooklyn and one in Venice Beach, Los Angeles.
He's moved to Los Angeles, I learn, in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think he's bi-coastal, as they call it.
Do they get
lives in his garage in Venice Beach.
Were the entrails from a kind of organically reared...
I don't think it was organically reared in Brooklyn in those days. Because this was before all the upper-middle-class musicians moved in, apart from the National, and gentrified it.
Now it'd be single-estate entrails, presumably.
It would be single-estate, well, locally
artisan,
sourced entrails.
Artisanal.
Yeah, why did they say artisanal?
It's then just... I can't speak. Herbal tea.
Let's move on. Nick Broomfield has previously made documentaries about Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love and Biggie and Tupac, not all in the same film. Those are two different films.
But all in heaven together.
All in heaven together. In his latest film, he told the story of Whitney Houston's life and death. Whitney, Can I Be Me premiered in cinemas this summer, but as a BBC co-production, made its way to TV last weekend. Did it make our guests so emotional? Or did they feel it was not right, but it was okay? Let's begin by hearing a bit of Whitney.
Friday night, you and your boys went out to eat.
Let's start with you this time, Matt. Do you now feel you have greater insight into the life and death of Whitney Houston?
No, I don't really, because I kind of knew, if not the grisly grim details about her career and descent and subsequent death, I kind of knew, felt that I knew all pretty much that I needed to know. I'd seen the photos of the crack-infused bathroom sink, and I'd, you know, and I'd seen the kind of videos where she, where her eyes are slightly kind of rolling into the back of her head, and you know, and obviously with these kind of documentaries, it goes into kind of the gory detail. There was quite an interesting thing about a childhood friend, which kind of was kind of ran all the way through it, and basically said that this woman who Robin, who had basically been with her from the beginning and kind of grew up with her in East Orange, New Jersey, was her kind of emotional anchor. And after Robin and Whitney's husband Bobby Brown kind of fell out, and Robin left the Houston kind of omniverse, that everything got, kind of went tits up. But you know what you have with these kind of programs is you don't have enough. It's not a big budget. It's, they spent a lot of money on kind of quite a lot of archive, which I hadn't seen before. I'm not a big, particularly big Whitney Houston fan, but you kind of felt there wasn't enough explanation of the joy that she brought and the examples of how fantastic her music is or was as kind of pop stuff. There was a lot of slightly pointed digs at Clive Davis from Arista for kind of like reducing her, taking her away from kind of black community. And, you know, there was one quite bizarre bit where one of her musical guys says, you know, he wouldn't have let any kind of funkadelic. Now, I would have liked to have been in the music. I would have liked to have heard Whitney Houston kind of over a kind of George Clinton funkadelic track, but I don't think it was ever going to happen, even if they'd have given her a complete free reign. And I kind of thought it was just a little bit... I never get the feel with a lot of Broomfield's musical documentaries that he's actually that bothered in the music, about the music. And that's why, surely, people should be kind of interested in the story.
I disagree completely. I mean, you're right in that it's definitely a film about her relationships. It's not... Well, there is some interesting stuff about how her becoming very pop alienated her from parts of the black music community. That is fascinating in terms of the music. But and the fact that she went on Soul Train and she was booed at a time when her star was riding so high that she didn't realise that there was this antagonism towards her. And that then sent her spiralling off into a relationship with Bobby Brown, which literally seemed to start on the same day. And also that she had very clearly, I mean, it's not been confirmed, but you leave the film with no doubt that she'd been in a relationship with Robert and her best friend, who's a woman.
Sorry, and I didn't say that, did I?
No. I mean, I think it's a film, it's about the patriarchy. It's about a woman who wants to be, I did get the impression, you know, she wants to be in a gay relationship. She can't, because that would have been such a difficult thing at that time. Under pressure, she spirals off towards this idiot sort of younger man who becomes very controlling. It's to me, it's a very textbook portrait of a controlling, abusive relationship, and it fascinates me that I mean, also her own controlling mother is a very strong figure in the film, so you can't just say it's men sort of pushing her around. But you know, it seems she leaves a very controlling relationship with her own mother and goes straight into the hands of a husband who manipulates her almost similarly. And I just found it fascinating because I grew up with Whitney Houston as a big glossy pop star, and I had sort of bought this myth that she was this good little Christian girl with this sort of amazing voice. And they talked about the fact that she was always from the hood. She'd always been around drugs. Well, this wasn't new. It wasn't that she got in with the bad boy and then discovered crack cocaine, because that's very much how it seemed to me as a naive young fan. They had sort of whitewashed her and not shown that she'd always been around
this
stuff.
This is the fascinating thing, isn't it? That the kind of the split between the Christian clean-cut girl and the really quite edgy girl was there from very, very young. You know, this kind of makes a lot of later life decisions much less inexplicable. And I think there were kind of some things missing from the film. One of the problems with the film is it had no access to official music. It could only use live footage shot on the 1999 tour by the guy who's actually credited as a co-director of the film. Because there's an official Whitney Houston film being made by Kevin MacDonald, who made Last King of Africa. So
I wonder if that'll go into all of this stuff.
So they, who knows? So they've got all the access to the music, and Nick Broomfield has the access to the people who want to say things that the estate don't want heard. But there were things like, you know, before Clive Davis signed her, she recorded with Bill Laswell for his project Material. And that was where she got noticed, making this, actually making experimental funk. So that stuff was there. It just doesn't feature in this story. And the other thing, whenever you watch something like this, is you're always thinking, who has got the axes to grind and why? That's inevitable with any documentary made about someone after their death. I think
the former English Special Forces agent who was her bodyguard and who basically says that he is Kevin Costner in real life.
He was amazing with his very commanding accent.
I submitted a memo to the management, which was her family.
Yeah, and his best line, if you're asking, would I have died for her? Yes, I would.
So, Robin Crawford, who isn't interviewed...
Yeah, which I thought was quite interesting.
I think because of that, actually comes out very much as the heroine of the film. She's the one that no one actually has a bad word to say about. Everyone agrees she had Whitney Houston's best interests at heart. And this kind of heartbreaking moment where Whitney is performing on stage and the camera is looking at Robin, who is sitting against the barriers, just in front of between the audience and the stage, and she's just gazing up at Whitney with adoration, singing along to every single word of the song. And you see in that moment the love that she had for Whitney, whatever the circumstances of their relationship. I'm inclined to agree with Sophie that probably they were in a more than friends relationship, but we don't know. But she loved Whitney, and she was excised from the camp by Whitney because she and Bobby Brown couldn't get on. And, you know, Whitney sided with Bobby Brown. And
it's the patriarchy.
As the bodyguard says, if Robin had stayed there, Whitney Houston would still be alive.
Well, Bobby Brown himself, who was, you know, absolute arch enemy of Robin, he has said the same thing. He has said she would be alive if she hadn't lost the friendship of Robin.
Yeah.
Robin's own father has also come out and said, oh, we knew they were in a relationship 40 years ago. This isn't news.
Hmm. Robin, you are not Robin Crawford,
no,
Whitney
not girlfriend,
Houston's
Robin
friend.
Well, I've got some got a bit of a surprise.
That mask is deep.
I hated it.
What?
I'm the wrong judge for these things because they're not the kind of things I watch. I don't like those kind of ambulance chasing documentaries. I found the lack of context made it impossible to watch. You know, you're hearing about how this person is a kind of, you know, she's bringing joy to so many people. She's, you know, or her career has kind of been, you know, is whitewashed or whatever. Yet you're not seeing a clip of I Want to Dance with Somebody, or, you know, you're just getting this. Somebody shot some footage while she's having her hair done or something like that. And I know, you know why that is. There's no access given because somebody doesn't want this bloke to be making the film. Why is this guy always making these films that no one wants to give him access to? Because he's an ambulance chaser. I find...
In his early career, he was kind of chasing ambulances. I mean, when I first kind of started watching or became aware of Nick Broomfield, he's been doing it quite a long time. But he did the kind of... Eugène Terre Blanche. He did one on Margaret Thatcher, which was quite, you know, putting himself in the story and running round after Margaret Thatcher and speaking to her.
With a
microphone and a kind of Nagra set around. And you kind of thought that his targets at that then were valid targets, you know, that there are people who didn't want to, who had a public image and didn't want to be... seen for it, and kind of going into artists, as he has done quite a lot recently, that are deceased.
Dead people. You kind of think, let them lie, man.
No,
you
know, I totally disagree. It's showing the exploitation that happens behind celebrity. It's investigative journalism.
But sometimes, as with the kind of Biggie and Tupac thing, it veers into kind of tin hattery, you know, tinfoil hattery. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's never afraid to pull a really outlandish theory off the wall and see if it's got legs.
I know I'm the wrong person to be talking about these things because I'd rather sit and watch a Netflix documentary about the guitarist of the Grateful Dead who's still alive and chugging away. It's like, you know, I could sit and watch that nonsense for hours, where something like this, it just immediately makes my skin crawl. And that's just personal opinion. I found it And had it had some of the music and had it had the context, but he said, you know why it doesn't have the music in there. It's not to do with the budgets. It's to do with the fact that no one wants him to have the music in there. You know, there was no... The performances as well, it wasn't even the performances of any of the big songs. So you would have had public... You know, you think that tour that would have been shot, it would have had all the big numbers. The publisher would have gone, you're not having that. You're not having access to that because it's a unauthorised thing. You know, people...
He's exposing the music industry. It's not that they don't want him to have it because they just want to protect Whitney. He's exposing all these people.
I found it. I don't know.
One thing I would say before we move on is that I think, well, first, you know, the similarities to the Amy Winehouse documentary are just absolutely staggering in any number of respects. But secondly, this is a story that gets played out at different levels across the music industry. The number of musicians I've interviewed you when it's been... You know, 4 years since their last album. Why has it been 4 years since their last album? I needed a break. Why do you need a break? Because this has become a career to me. People are dependent upon me. I did not get into music to be the person who has to support 5 bandmates, 10 crew, management, blah, 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 blah. Yeah,
record label.
What's different here is, of course, that you've got an entire family and friendship group who they're having to support as well. Mm. But, I mean, this is fundamentally the model of the music industry. The person with the talent has to support an awful lot of other people.
Yeah.
As you do, Robin. But let's move on. Those who hunt through the outer reaches of their TV guides will be aware of Sky Arts' propensity for offering the world vast numbers of music documentaries. Some of them are great. Metal Evolution might be the best music documentary series ever. Some less so. Newly launched is the channel's attempt to take on Tony Palmer's landmark All You Need Is Love with Rock and Roll, which purports to be nothing less than a 10-part history of rock music, with each episode themed around a topic. Episode 1, doubtless trying to offer everyone as much cheer as possible in trying times, was called Death, which of course meant that Black Sabbath appeared.
Gathered in their masses.
Of course, the ability to watch this depends on your Sky planner being functional at any given time. Do we have quorum on functional Sky?
Yeah. No, I do pay for my Sky planner, my Sky Arts, and it wouldn't blimming download.
Through the magic of Chromecast and my Now TV subscription that I get free with Vodafone, which is about the one good thing that you get with Vodafone, yes, I have seen it.
Well, tell me what you thought of it then, Matt.
I kind of really liked it because it wasn't a... It totally veered away from that. I was the first Sky Arts kind of music series I'd seen, and... It was a real relief not to see something that was from the BBC 4 Friday night school of let's go and be really dogmatic about the definite about something that we're going to look at, whether then it'll be the Gravesend R&B scene from 1972 to 1977. It was the complete opposite of that. It was a kind of complete mishmash, which is actually quite entertaining because it's kind of the way that you listen to music. So I quite liked Blixer Bargeld, who used to be in Einstein and Neubauten and is now a very dapper resident of Berlin. But that was next to the representative of the Scandinavian death metal scene, next to kind of Johnny Cash, next to, you know, it was thrown together. Kind of like, let's chuck all this shit at a wall and see what sticks.
Having watched those two, you know, in consecutive nights, having hated one, that was my perfect kind of programme. It sort of loosely drifted through a lot of stuff. I was trying to think, I can see there's a sort of overarching kind of idea here, death, but it kind of didn't really have a thread through it, and I liked it all the more for that. And the reason it showed up, the Nick Broomfield thing, for me, was the context. As soon as you see proper footage of Sabbath playing, you're hearing old crackly old Robert Johnson recordings, you're seeing Neubauten, you know, all these things, you're actually getting, you know, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison. You're watching, it's like, this feels like you're mainlining music history into yourself rather than your ambulance chasing or, And the stories were brilliant, you know, and the right people are telling them, you know, Roseanne Cash talking about her dad, things like that. You know, you're watching it and it's, I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. And the just the glow that came off the screen, the, you know, the guy at the start, Cedric Burnside, and you're watching it and it's just every shot is crisp and beautiful and it just had this sheen to it, which, you
and,
know.
And somebody, R. Murdoch Esquire, had ponied up, probably not realising it, but ponied up for, you know, we were talking about the kind of rights, and Robin was talking about the rights for the Whitney Houston music. Money was no object in this. They were kind of, you know.
I found it very curious because of what we just said. It is an absolute grab bag. I'll be curious to see what the rest of the series is like. I mean, they are almost unrelated little interviews with people. The shortest of which lasts about 20 seconds and then moves on to someone else. And so alongside Roseanne Cash and Tony Iommi and Geezer Butler, you get Chelsea Wolfe, and as she appears, and you go, why is she on? I don't understand. And you come to Roseanne Cash, like, okay, I understand this is going to be Johnny Cash. Then they're talking about Folsom Prison. You think, but you're calling it death. This isn't about death. It's very curious. The quality of interviewees is extraordinarily high. I mean, my impression is they
Thurston Moore was on it for about 10 seconds, wasn't he?
Interviewed, yes, Thurston Moore for 10 seconds. They interviewed thousands of people. They thought, oh God, we've got to make a series out of this, haven't we? Now, Sophie, you didn't see this, which makes you the ideal person to talk about.
It's never stopped me before.
Does the world actually need another series that is telling, even in the most tangential way, the history of rock and roll?
I mean, I would say no, but is that sacrilege?
No.
I don't think so. No, but as you say, it sounds like they've got a stellar lineup of people, but what a shame they didn't ask them something unexpected.
Like, how would you catch a bat if it was flying around your living room?
But you also kind of wonder, how, you know, I mean, they're trying to sort of set up Sky Arts as a competitor to BBC Four, and you kind of think, how many people are actually going to watch this stuff?
Exactly. I mean, how many viewers do they have? It seems a shame to hide it on there, but they do have these fantastic budgets.
But I suppose you end up with, you know, this kind of box set thing, you know, culture where you log all this stuff and it just becomes this, you know, it isn't a definitive history of rock and roll. It's kind of, you know, it's a load of mad interviews with people. But it's maybe, you know, maybe even at the time you're making it, you're just thinking, this is archive.
Or do you think they're going to end up managing to chop these interviews into 34 different series down the line?
Oh, yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
Nick Broomfield's already working on it.
That's nearly the end of the show, which means it's time for closing time chatter, where our guests tell us what's been occupying their minds this week. Sophie.
Well, I'm going to say his name wrong, but I went to see Karl Ove Knausgård, another Norwegian, actually. It's Norwegian week here. I went to see him give a talk in a bookshop in London to launch his new book, Autumn. Now, Knausgård is a sort of very successful memoirist who writes these books, which I think you either love them or hate them, although I actually do both. I sort of can't bear it, and yet I think he's fantastic. He writes these memoirs where he will tell you every detail of a conversation he had when he was 14, and then his subsequent trip to the toilet, and then his subsequent trip down the hill to borrow his friend's bike. I mean, there's seven in that series, and he's now doing a new trilogy of books, one of which is called Autumn. Now, Autumn, he said he wrote it as a sort of letter to his unborn daughter. She's now born, but she was his, I think, third or fourth child, and he wrote it when his wife was pregnant, and he gave this whole talk about it. None of us had read it yet because it was just coming out that day. And I was fascinated to think about a writer, you know, because I've written about my daughter and I'm writing a book. And I thought, oh, brilliant, a book to an unborn child. I like that. Then I got him to sign it. Then I got it home, flicked open at a chapter called labia. Labia is the name given to the oblong folds that from... And then he goes on explaining when an infant girl is lying on the changing... I cannot wait to read this book. He's written a whole thing to his unborn daughter with a chapter called labia.
He's vag-splaining.
He's vag-splaining. I mean, he's unbelievable. So, when I say he outlines every detail, it's sort of every wank, it's every piss, it's everything. So it is quite startling in a very unstartling context.
What's been bothering you, Robin?
nothing bothering me. I love this magazine, Lucky Peach, and it's such a beautiful thing, made by McSweeney's. It's their food magazine, and this is their last issue. I think they got to a point where they decided that they didn't want to do it anymore. I think they did it with The Believer, another McSweeney's thing, you know, another beautifully made magazine, and they just started it up again recently. The best bands are the ones you kind of split up with a, you know, or go out with a, in a blaze of glory and don't leave a long trail of crap at the end of it. And I quite like the idea of a magazine doing that, not just carrying on and finding, you know, what are we going to do this month? Oh, yeah. I just like the idea of this thing, this beautiful, you know, 20 issues or whatever, and that's it, done.
Were you ever a reader of Grand Royal?
That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
The magazine that was published when they could be bothered to put an issue together.
Well, I mean, yeah, that I could have done with a few more of them.
Yeah.
I think Grand Royal's... And also the fact that they've never bothered doing a collected version of those. Mm. You know, you think people would lap that up, but no, gone.
Matt,
I only found out this week, and I'm assuming that everybody else knew this, that the V&A have announced that they're going to do one of their big exhibitions on Winnie the Pooh, which is quite kind of pleasant, and I'm not sure exactly how it's going to carry off a kind of massive, you know, like a,
I didn't know this. A stone.
I know, that's quite good. I'm quite into the idea of that as well. What I didn't realise until reading the kind of report in The Guardian on this, is that the house that Christopher Robin grew up in and that A.A. Milne lived in when he wrote, so just outside the Hundred Acre Wood and all that kind of stuff, was later bought by Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones. And that's the house that he drowned in the swimming pool in. Did you know that? I thought that... It's called Cotchford Farm, and it's on the edge of Ashford Forest.
I've read Christopher Robin's moaning sort of memoir writing about what a terrible childhood he had. And I thought, well, that's funny, because I remember as a child being taken to the bookshop that you ran, adult Christopher Robin, in Dartmouth, trading on the Winnie the Pooh legacy. You know, you turned it into your career too.
You might have had a bad life, Christopher Robin, but you never ended up drowning in your swimming pool, did you?
Curiously, the other night I was out at the quite old school posh Italian restaurant Franco's in Jermyn Street.
Lovely.
And when I went to the toilet, they were playing a Winnie the Pooh audiobook. Who knows why?
Is it the one read by Alan Bennett?
I don't
yes,
know.
Yes, there is that one. I love that
one. That's
one
my daughter goes to sleep to every night.
A man once wooed me with that. In a sort of come up and listen to my records way. That happened. I mean, it worked a treat. I went out with him for about a year. He
that
played
wasn't the
me.
The free CD with The Guardian, was it?
No.
That's so cheap.
God, he had it on his iPod, maybe it was. He played me Alan Bennett. Really, really cool. That was it. I was in.
Imagine telling Alan Bennett.
There is nothing I can say to this that isn't going to be really bad.
Sophie, when exactly is your memoir out?
2019, frustratingly. Whole year and a bit to go.
And for me, well, I was at End of the Road this past weekend, where I saw the group Car Seat Headrest, who I'd studiously managed to avoid even listening to in any form. But I went to see them since they appear to have some sort of reputation and was rather surprised that they got a very big and what quite a grown-up festival, a very, very fervent crowd. It felt like every teenager on the site had gone to see them and knew every single word. But what also surprised me was that quite a lot of middle-aged blokes knew every single word as well. I'm not entirely sure how much I like them. I think they're kind of filling a Gaslight Anthem or Weezer-sized gap for emosh, loud guitar music, but there was something very, very persuasive about them. You know, they had that feeling of a group at that really, really exciting point where people are willing them to be something bigger. I suspect that their next London gig will be somewhere substantially larger than the Forum where they played the other day. They feel to me like a band who are going to be in arenas within 2 years. There is something extraordinary there, even if you don't like that kind of music, which I'm not mad about these days, but I mean, you must feel this sometimes, Sophie, when you see a group who you don't really particularly like, you think, I'd like to talk to them because I think there's something interesting going on there.
Absolutely.
That's the way I felt when I was watching
The National.
I want to interview them. I don't want to interview The National.
I don't want to know what The National have to say, actually.
No.
But I do like the records.
And that is the end of the show. Thank you, Sophie Hayward. And thank you, Robin Turner. Listeners, remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can subscribe in the podcast section via Apple Podcasts and the iTunes Music Store. And you can find us on Spotify as well. Thanks again for listening. Andrew Harrison will still be at his Ron Mail facial hair retreat next week, so you will again have me. I'm sorry about that, but it's the best we can do at short notice. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.